You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the SmartCast Micro Learning Podcast Series on metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Kia Jones, and I'm a medical director at Med Learning Group. This podcast is the third and final in this series titled Improving the Overall Safety and Quality of Care for Your Patients with Metastatic Hormone-Sensitive Prostate Cancer. How does your approach compare with the experts? This series is hosted by Dr. Andrew Armstrong, a medical oncologist and professor of medicine at Duke Cancer Institute in Durham, North Carolina. And with that, let's go ahead and get started.
Thanks, Kia. Hello and welcome. I'm Andrew Armstrong. I'm a medical oncologist and professor of medicine here at Duke. And we're going to start today's episode on disparities in access to novel therapies in men with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. And today I'm joined by my Duke colleague, Hannah McManus. She's also a medical oncologist, just joined our group practice this past year. She's now an assistant professor of medicine here at the Duke University School of Medicine. Hannah, it's great to have you here. It's our first podcast together.
Yeah, thanks, Andy, for the invitation. I'm excited to talk some more.
Yeah, so this is meant to be simply conversational about, you know, our practices and the research that's happening, that's ever evolving in this disease setting. So as you know, treatment landscape has changed very drastically in men who present with metastatic disease or who develop metastatic disease after local therapy. I would say in in my practice, it's really very seldom that we offer androgen deprivation therapy alone, and treatment intensification either with doublet therapy or triplet therapy has become the standard of care. However, we don't see that treatment has rolled out with the same degree of equity across the world, you know, and there's disparities that have emerged, you know, that continue to be presented at various, you know, ASCO or GU symposium meetings, and is reflected in some recent publications. So, Hannah, maybe we could just start off the conversation by, you know, talking about your practice and who you recommend doublet and triplet therapy for.
Yeah, so you raise a really good point. You know, we have all these trials that show us there's this clear benefit to treatment intensification, and that's great, but patients actually have to get those therapies in real world practice to benefit from those therapies. And, you know, like you said, we do see disparities in who is being offered and receiving these therapies. Similar to you, I think it's very rare that I recommend androgen deprivation therapy alone to a patient based on really good data that patients benefit from intensification with either a novel hormonal therapy or triplet therapy combining with chemotherapy. So I think, you know, it's the rare exception potentially in a patient who's extremely frail that I would potentially think about using just the monotherapy alone. And even then, I think we can, you know, it surprises me sometimes how well some patients, even with a lot of comorbidities, if managed well, can tolerate, you know, intensification with a novel hormonal therapy. So in general, I'm counseling patients that, you know, we should consider these intensified approaches. And then there's a little more nuance of like which hormonal therapy to use, or, you know, the patients where we're thinking about intensifying even further with docetaxel as well.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the data that I've seen suggests that maybe half of patients in the United States are still getting ADT monotherapy despite this very strong level one evidence and national, international guidelines supporting treatment intensification. I think when we looked at our Duke practice, we're at about 90% getting treatment intensification. And from the data that I've seen at ASCO and, you know, from big real world data sets, the factors that seem to be associated with lack of treatment intensification are, you know, perhaps socioeconomic. They track sometimes with race. Black men, Hispanic men seem to have a lower prevalence of treatment intensification. Older patients, rural patients, those treated in community centers by urologists versus, you know, the ivory towers that we work in. I have seen data that at the VA where there is equal access, that the prevalence is not there. The disparity is much less prevalent, that there's pretty equal representation. So maybe you could comment on, you know, I know we're preaching from the ivory tower, but what do you think are the, some of the barriers that are faced by men and by providers in getting these novel hormonal therapies to patients?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, you raise an important point that we're lucky to be in a setting where we have a lot of support and resources at a big academic center to support patients through these therapies. And there probably is some selection bias in some of these studies, you know, showing, you know, less use outside of academic centers where, you know, we're seeing the patients that actually get here. But still, I think there's important points there of like, there are certain things like, some of the comorbidities, potentially race, access to academic centers and medical oncologists that you raise that have been shown in studies to be barriers. And so, I mean, I think all of those things contribute. So socioeconomic factors are certainly a piece. These drugs are expensive, and we can maybe talk through some strategies that kind of help with improving costs and access to those therapies. But I think without really the robust support that we have from a pharmacy and financial side to help patients access those programs, it can be challenging to get these therapies.
Let's talk through each of these barriers. You know, I feel very lucky to have a specialty pharmacist in clinic with me. And, you know, often that's the next person to meet with the patient after we've made this treatment decision. And, you know, having that pharmacist there, either on site or virtually, who can follow up with the patient, who has access to forms and copay assistance programs, foundations, you know, is a game changer for us. And, you know, we're lucky to have that, but a lot of urologists may not have access to a pharmacist, even in the community. Many medical oncologists may not be as familiar, you know, with these agents and not necessarily think of them as a reflex. So, you know, what would be some suggestions that you have for you know, dealing with the financial toxicity, reducing the cost of care?
Yeah, that's a good point. So, you know, a lot of these drugs have assistance through the companies that can help when patients, you know, may not be able to afford them or have the appropriate insurance coverage to afford them. So I think it's putting a lot on providers, but still just knowing that those are resources that you can reach out to the companies or help direct patients to reach out to the companies, I think could be a helpful resource. There's, you know, some strategies like lower cost pharmacies. So abiraterone, one of these drugs, is now generic, and things like cost plus pharmacy, you know, can be resources for patients to be able to get these drugs at a lower cost.
In talking about abiraterone, I'm curious, have you ever tried the food effect to reduce patients' costs?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I have not personally yet, but I've got it in my back pocket, I think, thinking about it as an option for patients. So, you know, that idea that you can, with food, give a lower dose of abiraterone and thus use, you know, a lower number of pills, and so actually have less cost of drug for patients. And as you point out, there's data showing efficacy and safety doing that. And so for patients that are having to buy the therapies at, you know, higher cost, this can be a cost reducing strategy. I think, yeah. How about you?
Yeah, no, I have several patients who are on this, and sometimes this happens in the middle of treatment. Let's say a patient's been on abiraterone for a year or two, and then suddenly their insurance changes and they're faced with a massive copay and they can't afford it and there's no assistance for them because it's generic. This happened to me just last week. And, you know, the question from the pharmacist would be, you know, is it appropriate for this patient to consider taking, you know, one tablet with a low-fat diet, which is what Russell Schmolowitz published, showing basically the same drug levels as four pills on a empty stomach, you know, and so in many cases, I'll do that. It's not my default, you know, because most patients, you know, we don't have as strong level one evidence for this approach, but showing the PSA outcomes and safety and pharmacologically, you're basically delivering the same amount with a low-fat diet is pretty compelling. And, 75% cost savings is pretty compelling as well. This food effect doesn't exist for darolutamide or Enza or APA, so it's really restricted to Abby, but Abby is a great medicine, and you know, because it's less expensive, is often, you know, a default choice for many patients, even though it may have, you know, mineralocorticoid excess or prednisone and other side effects. So for the other drugs that are not Abby, you know, what are some of the methods that you have found successful to get these patients access to these drugs?
So that concept of getting sort of patient assistance programs through the companies, like for these non-generic drugs, I think I've been, you know, it varies from patient to patient, and I still am not always totally clear on the specifics of like what helps patients qualify, but I've had patients really benefit from a cost standpoint to where they were able to get the drugs that they otherwise would not have been able to afford the copays.
Asking about the veteran status of your patients sometimes helps. A lot of fully connected veterans can get full access to their medicines through the VA. And, you know, the guidelines are pretty clear to consider these as life-prolonging agents. Despite the increased mortality that Black men face from prostate cancer, their inclusion in clinical trials is pretty paltry, you know. About 12-13% of men with prostate cancer are Black. In our patient population here in Durham, it's about a quarter. In the VA, it's about half of men. But in most clinical trials in phase three, it's somewhere about 3-5% are Black men. And so we do see associations with lack of treatment intensification by race. That's definitely concerning because while these men are facing a higher mortality, but when they're included in clinical trials and every single study that we've looked at, whether it's with Cipullus LT or abiraterone or docetaxel, and just at ASCO this past year, we looked at abiraterone plus apalutamide, and in every single one of those studies, including VA studies, Black men do very well when they're in clinical trials, if not better than the same matched white men with the same condition treated with the same medicine. So it's almost like there's a double disparity by not including them and then, you know, not necessarily offering the treatment or them not receiving the treatment when they're benefiting even more. So I wonder if you could comment about, you know, why you think Black men in clinical trials are doing so well and what, you know, how we can translate that into real world.
Yeah, it's huge. And your point of the double disparity, both, you know, maybe not like Black men not being and having the opportunity to be involved in these trials, but also it sort of influences the information we operate off of as a community. So if we have less, you know, Black men represented in trials, we may be deciding that therapies are not effective or vice versa. On a general population level that really isn't taking into account those potentially like differential outcomes for Black men. And so I think, you know, access, like how do we improve sort of enrollment, like diversity in clinical trials? You know, there's a couple aspects. So some, I think we often think about sort of the historic background of, mistrust and mistreatment around clinical research with Black individuals in the U.S. And I think there's understandably a lot of truth to that, but it's unfortunate that then harms, you know, people now living today. And so education, continued efforts at, you know, building trust between the Black community and the clinical trials community, I think is really important to ensure equal access to care. You know, one piece in terms of enrolling is just, do you ask patients? So there's some data that when approached, Black patients are equally, you know, willing to participate in clinical trials. And it's actually on the provider side that they're not being approached as frequently. So continuing, I think, to make that push within our community of like, we need to ask patients to be involved in trials.
You know, I think, you know, assuming that a Black patient is not interested is wrong. Assuming that they're not going to tolerate a therapy is wrong. And making sure that you're just asking, not just about trials, but about these treatments. And, you know, even though many Black patients, for example, in our Abby Race study had additional comorbidities like diabetes, you know, weight changes, hypertension, they could still tolerate these therapies, and more men with metastatic CRPC were alive at 2 and 3 years, which was fantastic. So I think giving them the best opportunity possible, and they may have different side effects, you know, because of those comorbidities. So it's important to monitor patients carefully, but to give them the best opportunity to live longer.
Completely. And you raise a good point about the inclusion criteria there for abiraterone and thinking about, you know, really how strict do we need to be with our inclusion criteria? Sometimes in trials helps expand enrollment. So, you know, potentially being more inclusive of pre-existing comorbidities, like things like hypertension and diabetes, both helps increase diversity in trial enrollment, but could also, you know, make our data more applicable to the patients we're treating. Because if we're, you know, including less than 5% Black men in a trial, and then you said it's a quarter of the population we're treating, are we really getting the best data to inform our real world practice?
The generalizability of our trial data is really important because these patients are going to be offered this treatment in the real world. And yeah, I remember in the abiraterone and PANTHER studies, we went through somewhere around 20 amendments to refine our eligibility to make it more accessible and inclusive. You know, differences in GFR and washout periods and drug-drug interactions and baseline blood pressure really should not be exclusionary, but, you know, should be reasons to follow patients carefully and co-manage, you know, those comorbidities. Because ultimately, these men with metastatic disease are more likely to die of prostate cancer than these other causes. You know, it's not just about the AR inhibitors. We've published on immune therapy with Sipulis LT. This is in the PROCEED study. African-American men were much more likely to have a more prolonged survival when treated with this form of cellular immunotherapy. Susan Hallaby here at Duke has done a meta-analysis of all the docetaxel trials and looked at race, and African-American men did better with docetaxel. And in our PANTHER study, dual AR blockade was particularly and very interestingly much more effective in Black men. And the dual blockade failed in white men. You know, the ACEs study and in our PANTHER study, those self-identified white men did not seem to benefit from dual AR blockade, while Black men who were not included in the ACEs study really had a profound PSA better outcome and RPFS outcome and survival outcome. Why do you think that is? You know, why do you think Black men, you know, race is not a biologic property, but ancestry is. And so do you think there's something to ancestral biology that might be creating exquisite AR sensitivity there?
Yeah, I think that's a huge point that we should always be really cognizant of, is that race is a social construct. And we're using this term to lump together what's really trying our best at classifying ancestry and from that genetic ancestry as a potential driver of differential responses to therapy. And so, you know, we're lumping together as best we can with the, you know, self-reported race, like potentially African ancestry. And, you know, I think that is one piece. There's likely genetic and biologic differences in, you know, cancer biology and drug metabolism that help explain those differences. I mean, I think that's a big area of continued needed research and growth, is to understand what is driving those differences in response on a biologic level.
I mean, Nima Sharifi's published on the 3-beta-HSD1 gene, which does differ by ancestry. CAG repeats in the AR differ by ancestry. Inflammatory genes and the activation, you know, differ by ancestry. And so there's a host of candidates there that might explain all these observations. And, you know, we're trying to figure this out now. We've started with is an inclusive study. You know, if you don't do the inclusive studies, you'll never find these clinical observations to then ask the important biologic questions, is how you might improve these patients' outcomes long-term. You know, so I'd like, maybe we could finish by bringing this back to the hormone sensitive situation. You know, how would you take all these, you know, race-based studies showing better outcomes and apply this to the hormone sensitive situation, assuming that there can be equal access to care.
So like thinking about how would I apply this in my clinical practice or in research?
Or in research, you know, would there be any studies you'd like to see done in this hormone sensitive disease state?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a research standpoint, we need to show that there's these differences on a hormone sensitive setting. And this is really probably our best opportunity to impact clinical practice now, because we have all these great studies showing differences in response to novel hormonal therapies and chemotherapy in the CRPC setting. But like we talked about before, we really should be intensifying treatment in the MHSPC setting now. So most patients are going to be receiving or should be receiving these therapies when they have hormone sensitive disease. And so, some of these, I think, race parallel cohort studies trying to understand this biology and show better outcomes potentially with more intensified hormonal therapy, like the idea of the abiraterone apalutamide combination or things like that may help, I think, sort of fine tune and nuance our care in the MHSPC setting.
So just to wrap this up and summarize, we need to improve access, improve affordability. We need to ask both for clinical trials, and we need to communicate to our patients, whether you're a urologist, community oncologist, rural or academic, it needs to be part of your general discussion for a metastatic patient, just regardless of race, socioeconomic status, that this is the standard of care, level one evidence, life-prolonging therapies. From a research perspective, it would be great to have some real-world data in this hormone-sensitive setting by race, but ideally some prospective studies that are very inclusive to look at, this kind of new finding of combined AR blockade, both with a CYP17 inhibitor and a ligand binding domain inhibitor. I think that would be really interesting with a wealth of correlative studies to validate this and in a setting where we're actually using these agents. So, and maybe even earlier than that, in a curative intent setting would be even better.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think, this is just right now thinking about intensifying these therapies in the MHSPC setting, but ultimately, yeah, we're trying to cure patients, even earlier and always can explore these ideas.
Exactly. Like the EMBARK study or the STAMPEDE study and future trials like ATLAS and DAZZLE HICAP and ENZA-RAD. I mean, these AR inhibitors are just moving into settings where maybe we can prevent metastatic disease in the first place and cure more men. And we don't want to see that disparity repeated.
Exactly. Yeah. No, good. Great summary.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. It was a great conversation. There's still so much to be done to address these racial and socioeconomic disparities in prostate cancer treatment and clinical trials. We appreciate the time you've taken to spend time with us today. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for the invitation. Look forward to continuing to discussing and working on these issues for our patients together.
And thank you to our listeners for joining us. This podcast was brought to you by Med Learning Group. Med Learning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. And a special thank you to our grant supporter, Janssen, who provided an educational grant for this activity.